Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. I'll just offer a few reflections, try to be reasonably brief, since it's already long into the evening. So Stanislaus has now taken on this commitment of living on the eight precepts for the next year, to live the life of Anagarika. And this is a form established by the Buddha. And one of the teachings that I like to reflect upon and to bring into consciousness, bring into the picture in relationship to both making a commitment to live as an Anagarika, but also the use of the eight precepts as a standard for the lay community to be using as, say, people who are resident in the monastery or lay people living outside the monastery, taking that on one day a week. It's a small teaching, a simple teaching that the Buddha gave, describing his own formulation of the eight precepts, where it came from in his own thoughts. And here and there in the suttas, you get this kind of scenario where the Buddha is describing his own train of thought, his own ponderings, and this is one such occasion that he does this. He's just by himself and considering, what can we do about this? We have this situation. How can we work that? What's going to be useful here? And I feel this is a very, very helpful principle to bring to mind and to keep recollecting as an ongoing presence, because it helps to inform the way that we hold the renunciate life, the commitment to keeping precepts. Just as I was saying to Anagarika Stanislaus just now, we can relate to the precepts in terms of closing the door on our outgoing energies, our habits of aggression, so we give up killing things, our habits of greed, we give up stealing and taking what is not given, we give up sexual activity, we refrain from engaging with others through those means, seeing others in those ways or presenting ourselves to others in those ways and pursuing that kind of a dimension of human relationship. Refraining from lying, from aggressive speech, from backbiting, from gossiping, and so forth. And all these precepts, we talk about refraining from, and we are sort of stemming the outgoing energy. So it can feel like a lot of not this, not that, don't this, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. And that's the refrain, haha, is refraining from. Yeah. But you say that over and over again. And even the English word renunciation has this implication or this tone of, this is something that is you would really like, or something that is really good, or is really natural, but you're going to develop the strength to go without it, to manage without having that particular thing. Christian tradition, say in Lent, you renounce food with salt in it, or you just live on bread and water, or you renounce alcohol for the space of the 40 days of Lent. that you would really like to have it, but you're going to give it up so that you develop some spiritual oomph. So we can relate to the word renunciation in that way, as a state, representing a state of lack or incompleteness. But when you consider the word brahmacharya, which is used in particular for celibacy, but it also can refer to the whole sort of anagarika form, or the construct of the eight precepts is the brahmacharya life, or taking on brahmacharya precepts for one day a week, or however long that might be, for a period of retreat or some such. And the word brahmacharya literally means divine conduct. Brahma means pure or divine, holy. And then charya is from charana, charity, the verb to act or to walk, to fare. So it's divine activity, walking with the gods. It's a pure conduct. You know, all these words sort of relate to that. So that rather than representing a state of lack or diminution, it's more representing a divine quality. So this is a far from a state of going without. It's more of a state of having extra. It's a whole different way of holding it. So the brahmacharya life is in the Buddhist tradition, and also I think within the Indian tradition generally, it's seen as, yes, there's a laying aside of other external behaviors, activities, possibilities, but it's because of that, that in that laying aside, you're opening up the access to greater fullness. So the Buddha's own ponderings on this is in the Upposatha Sutta, in the Sutta number 47 in the Book of the Sevens, I think, in the Anguttara Nikaya, if I remember correctly. 747, that's how I remember. But I could be wrong. I think it's Sutta 47 in the Book of the Sevens. Anyway, it's called the Upposatha Sutta, and it just simply recounts the Buddha's formulation of the eight precepts, and it arises from his recognition of the conduct an enlightened being. So he says, all their lives, the arahants, you know, from the time of their enlightenment, an arahant never deliberately takes the life of another living being. Wouldn't it be good for the lay community, you know, one day a week, if they gave up taking the life of other living beings? And in that way, they would live as the arahants live, and that will be for their long-lasting welfare and happiness. And so too, then, with the other precepts, from all their lives, from the time of their enlightenment, an arahant does not deliberately take that which is not given to them. They refrain from sexual activity. They refrain from false and harmful speech. They refrain from gossiping and backbiting, lying, and abusive speech. They refrain from intoxicants. They refrain from eating in the inappropriate part of the day. They refrain from entertainment, beautification, adornment, singing and dancing, wearing adornments and perfumes and so on. And they choose a simple, low sleeping place to rest. And for each one, there's the same refrain. If they act in that way, then in this way they will be acting as the arahants do, and that will be for their long-lasting welfare and happiness. So this is a very different way of holding the quality of the precepts, rather than a whole list of things that you can't do. You can't do this, can't do this, can't do this, and feeling of setting up an attitude of limitation or frustration just in the thinking patterns, the description of it. Rather, it's, this is how I can access my fullness, the quality of puna, in Pali, not punya, but puna, with dots under the ends. Puna is fullness or completeness. And so that it's a whole different take, a whole different way of regarding that quality of limitation. And similarly, this was formulated by the Buddha in particular in relationship to the eight precepts and establishing that as a pattern for the lay disciples to use 1 day a week on the lunar quarters. But it pertains in an identical fashion for the monastics, those on 10 precepts or 227 precepts or 313 precepts or whatever. The different forms and styles of the renunciate way, it's built upon the same skeleton, the same framework, and that by formally adopting these behaviors, we are living as an arahant does, so that by giving up taking life, by giving up stealing, by giving up sexual activity and giving up harsh and false speech, rather than frustrating some intrinsic and natural, you know, good and natural process, what we're doing is we're tapping into that in our own nature. Say, in giving up, in the first precept, you're in refraining from killing, what you're doing is you're tapping into that dimension of your being which is completely incapable of violence. That aspect of your own, of your jitta, the unconditioned, pure aspect of the jitta, which is completely incapable of violence, which is completely incapable of acquisitiveness, that is completely uninterested in sexual activity, that is completely incapable of lying or deceiving or seeking self-advantage through communication, through speech, that is utterly uninterested in being distracted or confused or heedless through drink or drugs. It's just not interesting. It's not appealing. That in the heart, which is, despite all of the wonderfully inspiring comments about food yesterday evening at the our sharing circle, there is also that dimension of our being which is completely uninterested in food. That it's really just like shoveling coal into the furnace of the body, and it's just a fuel for the system. And we appreciate the great care and goodness and love that goes into the food preparation. But there's also something in the heart that can recognize, well, it's just to keep me alive. That's all. You know, the flavors make it appealing, but it's just to keep the body alive. That's all. Very simple. Just fill up the tank and let it run on that for the rest of the day. Easy. No big thing. So in that respect, we are looking at the precepts as a way of drawing upon our own pure heart. They're a way of calling upon that aspect of our life which is extraordinarily robust, that doesn't need a lot of stuff in order to feel happy, that is basically content and whole and resilient, that doesn't have to have particular conditions of clothing or weather or human company or entertainment or food or any of that. Things don't have to be in a particular way for us to feel content and happy. So that it's developing, taking on the eight precepts then is, in a sense, adopting the behavior that in your own heart of hearts you're really inclined towards. That's what's drawn each of us into the gate here at Amravati, that has brought us into the spiritual domain. That's what's pulled us in, a sense of attraction to simplicity, attraction to goodness, the love of the good, and delighting in simplicity, delighting in honesty, the company of good people. There is a real joy in that. So that when taking on the eight precepts, as Stanislaus has done for this coming year, to test out the monastic life, I would really encourage holding it in that spirit. That it's a spirit of simplification, but also a spirit rather than just of going. Even though part of us will feel a lot of going without, and like, I really want this, or I could do with more than that, I can't stand this. And we feel that chafing or that friction, because that's going against our habits of self-centered craving and attachment. And that's completely natural. That's when you come into a monastery, you meet all of your unfinished business. It's like you call the bills in. It's like, please, send in the bills. You know, okay, I'm ready to start paying them off. You know, all the outstanding debts and unfinished business. It's like you're sending out an all points. Invitation, please come in. Yes, show up. Let me know how much I owe here. Send in all of the bills, and so we meet that. But the monastic life and meditation in particular is designed to create that encounter, and you should expect friction and difficulty in that. But it's not because we want pain or more problems, but it's more that's what has to happen. That friction has to be experienced if we're not just going to be swept along by the current of habit and fear and selfish habits, aversion and desire, acquisitiveness and pride and jealousy and so forth. So that if we do experience that quality of friction, it's because we're going against the stream. It's like Ajahn Chah said, entering into monastic training can be like stepping into a cage with a tiger. You know, it's not like you come into the monastery and, oh, it's all sweetness and light floating around on little purple clouds waiting to deliquesce blissfully into Nibbana. No. It's more the locked in a cage with a tiger experience of being with our own mind, being with our unfinished business, being with our raging addictions and habits and preferences and fears, meeting them, knowing them, digesting them. And that very friction, Ajahn Chah would say that if we hold the blade at the right angle, then that very friction is what helps to sharpen the edge of the wisdom sword. You need that friction to keep your edge keen. That's how we use it skillfully. But we're not trying to frustrate or go without something that is essential. What I really like to encourage is seeing the monastic form and then taking on the Anagarika life, also for the lay community. Many of you live here year-round or lived here for many months and spend a lot of time here, using the eight precepts as a form to create a structure of living, to be seeing it in that way, to be seeing how this quality of great contentment, this quality of great ease, it's provided, it's supported through the simplification in our relationships that comes with the commitment to the precepts, then it creates an environment, a zone, of sanctity, a zone of sanctuary, of real peacefulness, and a sense of respect and trust and ease. We can live at peace with each other. The last part of the ceremony, probably most people are familiar with the Acharyo Me Bhante Hohi. That's Stanislaus was formally asking for me to be his teacher, the Acharya. And I agreed to that. Opaikan Padirupang. Yes, this is suitable, this is appropriate. Pasadikena sampadehi, please carry on diligently. Also after that, then the words that the candidate, person who's going forth, pronounces Ajitage Dani Tero Mahangparo Ahampitera Sabaro is from this day forward I will be the burden of the elder and the elder's burden will be mine. So that means Stanislaus makes the tea and I give the Dhamma the Dhamma talks. He'll do the laundry and I'll help guide him through his difficulties and knots and tangles of meditation. That's the deal. You make a deal. It's so simple, so beautiful. I will be the burden of the elder, and the elder's burden will be mine. So, like a parent-child relationship, teacher-student, it's a very simple and clear setup. And I feel it's very beautiful and appropriate to establish that right from the beginning. Everyone, we both realize this is a burden. Okay, there's some work. There's work involved here. But you're both consciously agreeing to it. You say, okay, I'll take you on. Okay, yeah, I'll do the laundry. I'll make the tea. Okay, we agree to that. Okay, it's a deal. So then you establish that sense of relatedness. And so when we're going forth, you know, anagarika, anagara, gara is a house. Anagara is, you know, going out from the house, out from the home. So one who has no house, one who has no home, anagarika, is the homeless one. So in going forth into the anagarika life, you're giving up the supports of a financial income, the supports of a family. If you have that, the whole worldly structures of a life propped up by insurance policies and work qualifications, your curriculum vitae, you know, all of those things that we take refuge in and we prop our lives up with, our income, our work record, our properties, our bank accounts, and so forth. As an anagarika, you can still hang on to the money and so forth. That isn't given up yet, but one's moving in that direction. Leaving the household life, the securities of the family, the securities of property, of money, of worldly insurances. But in that going forth, that there is a vulnerability there. You're deliberately stepping out of the house. You're out into the out of the home, into the wide world. So there's a vulnerability there. There's an exposure to the elements. And that's deliberate. But in that stepping forth, then it's not as though the Buddha leaves us out in the middle of the traffic, as it were. In that going forth, that it's based around the three refuges. You go forth into the refuge, so that it's not there's no lack of protection. In fact, what you're going forth into is a greater protection than any insurance policy can provide. That any amount of property, any kind of job security contract, far more the actual protection and insurance that the three refuges provide is far, far greater than anything that you can get through I don't even know what the insurance companies are in Britain anymore. Through Lloyds Bank or through Prudential Life and so forth. And that taking dependence on a teacher, that's also a part of that establishment of a security that is far more reliable than an income and a reputation and a home and a material family. Because taking dependence on a teacher, it's like you're entering into a situation of apprenticeship, so that the person undertakes to be available, to be able to teach, to share their knowledge, their understanding, their what they know of the terrain of the mind and the ways of training and so forth. And it's a relationship, it's definitely a bond, you're deliberately forming a bond, but it's a relationship that is to do with helping to support the realization of selflessness, which seems a bit of an oxymoron, or it seems a bit contradictory, but that's what it's for. It's a relationship that helps you to see beyond self, beyond relationships, beyond self and other. That's what it's designed to do. It's not designed to increase attachments or to increase an emotional reliance, but it's a dependency, like you use a set of crutches if you've got a broken leg, or you have training wheels on a bicycle. You know, you need that extra support before you learn how to ride a two-wheeler. You need the crutches before your leg is healed. We need that support, and then we can, so that in due course we can make it on our own. So it's that kind of a spirit that it's held in. So it's a definite setting up of a connection, a relationship between oneself and self and other. But it's, again, I like to emphasize, this is what it's for. It's not to compound the sense of self and other, me the student, you the teacher, or whatever. But more, its purpose is to help us see beyond self and other, to see beyond inside and outside, subject and object, and to let that whole construction disappear, to be seen as empty, void of substance. Because homelessness, the home is in a way a physical symbol or manifestation of the feeling of self, my home, my house, my property, I'm a person of substance. that homelessness, going forth into the homeless life, is a very powerful way of supporting going forth into selflessness, going forth from the trying to build a life around a sense of self to building a life around selflessness, around not-self, around this fundamental insight of that the Buddha shared and expounded so fully and brilliantly. So we're going forth from the household life into homelessness, going forth from the self-based life into selflessness. That's the point. That's the real going forth, is that internal one. It's not to become an anagarika, or become a monk, become a nun, become an upasaka. Yeah, there's an identity, but more we're using that structure, that those relationships that come from belonging to an order, being in a student relationship, to free our hearts from that any kind of reliance or dependency that when stream entry is arrived at, when that irreversible realization of Dhamma has been reached, then the term that the Buddha uses, is used over and over again in the scriptures, is that person becomes independent in the teacher's training, independent in the master's training. Like, you don't need a teacher anymore, you're seka. You don't need any more training, you don't need a teacher, there is independence. And so that's what there is, the spirit of that kind of commitment is being made in. So you are sincere in making that commitment, but you're not turning it into an identity, just as taking robes as a nun or as a monk. Yeah. It's not an identity. It's just an empty set of perceptions that have no fundamental substance, but we use them because they are a convenient fiction. It's like words, they're just noises, but you put them together in a certain order and they can carry meaning. And this is the great miracle, that you can formulate sounds to convey meaning, and that meaning is real, even though the sounds are empty of substance. The meaning and the change that the meaning can bring in our hearts is quite of quite another order, is of a genuine and a fundamental quality. So this is a real miracle, an amazing thing. So these are just a couple of themes I wanted to bring into the picture on this occasion of Stanislaus taking the eight precepts, and to encourage him and wish him the best for his year in white, and to express the good wishes of the Sangha, and trust that this will be as Ajahn Chah was also fond of saying, Nibbana Pacheyo Hotu, a cause for the realization of Nibbana. Anyone? Namayam Dhammo Arhatasadukaram Namasaya.